Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And today on Class Matters, we're going to dive into part two of an article that we began last week. It's by a Midwestern doctor. That's the pseudonym of a Midwestern doctor who fears the repercussions if he were to publish under his own name because he's revealing unethical and sometimes criminal conduct in the medical profession and the role of Big Pharma, etc. So he uses that pseudonym. You can find the article we've been sharing with you at his website, MidwesternDoctor.com. Lots of great stuff there. This guy is a very prolific writer, and all of his articles are very well sourced. There's links to the original sources and so on. The one we've been sharing with you is called The Century of Evidence That Vaccines Cause Sudden Infant Deaths. Now, last week, we got into the beginnings of it where he kind of talked about the business model of the vaccine industry. I almost said vaccine injury, but it's almost synonymous. But anyway, and talking about the fact that this drives the medical industry into all kinds of unethical practices because it's all about making money regardless of the human cost. And talking in general about unethical human experimentation being some of the consequences of this. And we haven't even really gotten to the heart of the article yet, but we're going to today. Where we left off, he was talking about the whole model of forced vaccinations. You know, you've got literally a captive market, and you've got compromised agencies like the CDC and the FDA and the school system and so on pushing vaccinations on people.
Well, children.
On children, yeah, especially. You've got, boy, what a great business model. You know, you're forcing people to take your product.
And you are not liable if it causes harm.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet.
So picking up where he left off, he says, in most cases, the business model around vaccines places intense pressures on the vaccinators to vaccinate. And he points out that veterinarians and pediatricians can only financially support their practices if they regularly vaccinate their patients. Points out that corruption is rife throughout the military's experimental vaccine programs. And then Medicare, through so-called quality measures, a component of Obamacare, such as this one, financially penalizes doctors who fail to vaccinate most of their elderly patients.
Not only that, but Obamacare penalizes institutions like hospitals and clinics who don't have all their employees vaccinated.
Yeah.
For a long time, Big Pharma was kind of limited to the pediatric market. They could force their vaccines on children, but they couldn't force them on adults. But they've slowly been getting over that. A big step forward, of course, was Obamacare,
right,
when everybody that worked in the healthcare profession had to be vaccinated every year against flu.
Right.
And then, of course, we just saw the COVID debacle, right? That's a big market right there.
Oh, yeah.
And then they started pushing the flu shot for the adults, which most adults are like, right. But the elderly would fall for it because they go to the doctor more and their doctor's pushing them. So they've really been branching out in terms of the age groups they target.
Yeah.
And this is how capitalism works. Capitalism has to expand its markets or the profit goes down and the company may go out of business.
Yeah.
In competition with corporations who expand their markets. So they can never just be content with just manufacturing something year after year and making a modest profit and okay, everything's fine. No. That's
right.
Not how they work.
Right, exactly. That's the way corporations die if they don't constantly expand. I think that's a very profound and accurate observation.
Well, Karl Marx made it.
So the Midwestern doctor goes on and says, there are many sad stories of the forced medication of these groups. For example, I have many astounding stories from friends who are subject to it. For the elderly over the years, I've heard many stories of nursing homes where numerous residents suffered significant illnesses immediately following the annual vaccination of their facility, and I have admitted a few patients to the hospital for a severe injury that onset immediately following influenza or pneumococcal vaccination.
Yeah, this is something they did with COVID. They rolled out the mandatory vaccinations in nursing homes like January 2021. And people, nursing homes who had gone through the entire outbreak without any COVID, because unless the New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania governors put COVID patients into nursing homes, there's no way they would really get it, right? Because they aren't out and about. But that's how they killed off a lot of people, but only at the nursing homes where they put the COVID patients. But nursing homes that had never had a thing of COVID, like the day 24 to 48 hours after the vaccine, all of a sudden people were saying that work there, right? I have maybe one person die on my shift a week. And the day after they're vaccinated, I had 8 patients die, right?
Yeah.
But guess what? How they got around that? They said they died of COVID. They put COVID on their death certificate.
Wow. Yeah. The Midwestern doctor goes on and says, during the recent vaccine push, I had numerous friends whose parents suffered a rapid and subsequently fatal cognitive decline immediately following COVID-19 vaccination. And I know someone who worked at a nursing home, which experienced multiple deaths immediately after the vaccine was administered. Similar stories have also been reported elsewhere. Again, he's got links. Now, at this point, he goes on and shares a number of personal stories. These are very interesting. If you read the actual article at MidwesternDoctor.com, recommend, you know, reading this whole thing. But for our purposes on the radio, I want to skip down a little bit over some of this, even though they're very powerful stories, and get to kind of the meat of this thing, and that is the historical evidence connecting vaccination to sudden infant death syndrome. He begins, in many cases, the only ones who can recognize the impact of an environmental change contributing to a disease are those in practice before and after the toxin was introduced. One of my fundamental objections to evidence-based medicine, so-called evidence-based medicine, is that our current religion of science believes that humans are irrational and incapable of accurately interpreting events in their environment. Because of this, whenever someone observes a correlation that questions a medical dogma, it is reflexively argued no causation, and often no correlation exists, and that the perception one did was simply the product of a variety of erroneous cognitive biases.
You know, what's so weird is that medicine is basically a subjective science. It's all about how the patient responds.
Yeah.
It always has been, right? Well, let's try this and see. I mean, that's how they do with pills. Let's try this pill and see if it helps.
Right.
Does it help? No? All right, we'll try this pill then. I mean, that's what they do.
Right.
Oh, that pill helps? Good. But you have that side effect? Here's another pill. See if that, I mean, it's all about the subjective experience. But if someone says, I got injected and then that night I was paralyzed, there's no correlation.
Yeah.
Prove it.
Right.
What do you mean prove it? That's exactly how science works. You take a whole bunch of causes and effects and you see if there's some sort of correlation.
Yeah.
But if you are determined not to, if you're determined not to gather evidence, then you're not going to find it now, are you?
That's exactly right.
You have to gather the evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it's also controlling for different variables. That's also part of it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Most of this is based on subjective reporting. And, well, there's also observations of, you know, if the patient dies, obviously, that's one thing. But, yeah, a lot of it is based on reported effects. He goes on to say, the problem with this argument is that the so-called science to establish causation on most controversial topics will never be done.
Exactly.
Due to the controversial nature of the subject. So an impossible standard is created for any unconventional viewpoint to meet. Additionally, while the unconscious biases explanation can be credibly argued to dismiss a causation that only has a weak correlation behind it, if a strong correlation is present and no other explanation exists for the correlation, the burden of proof and the need for further scientific studies rests on disproving rather than proving the causation. I think that's a very profound and accurate observation on
this
part.
Yeah, it is. And remember that almost all science starts with someone noticing some sort of correlation and wondering, I wonder if that has any meaning, and then experimenting to see.
Yeah, right.
But you can't do it, like he says, you can't do it with this. Oh, no, there's money in the way.
Yeah, you don't want to interfere with that.
No.
These conflicting epistemological perspectives have far-reaching consequences. In the earlier days of medicine, countless valuable insights could be obtained by reading the early medical literature and the treatment successes of physicians trying to understand the diseases they were encountering. For example, many of my original successful protocols for treating COVID-19 were developed from studying the long-forgotten approaches to managing viral pneumonia, devised by individual doctors on the front lines and subsequently proven throughout the 1918 influenza pandemic. Nowadays, it is incredibly rare to read case reports highlighting the same vital investigative processes by clinicians, as anyone who authors such a report exposes themselves to significant liability for violating the standard of care and, quote-unquote, experimenting upon their patients.
Oh, you got to follow the protocol.
Right, that's right.
No matter how illogical, follow that protocol.
Yeah. I am only able to hear of these reports through word of mouth from many valuable contacts I have cultivated over the years, and as a result, the knowledge base that can successfully treat a wide range of complex illnesses is virtually inaccessible to most of the population who lack that same access. And here might be a good point to remind listeners that last week we talked a little bit about how the FDA and the CDC were recently forced to withdraw all the stuff they said about ivermectin. Remember that?
Yeah.
You know, it's horse paste, you know, stop it, you're harming yourself, even though ivermectin was shown in a number of studies to be very effective, especially if it was applied early against COVID.
Well, they said it wasn't used by humans, but it has been used, got the Nobel Prize for being used on humans for stopping river blindness.
Yeah.
And then they sat there and told us with a straight face that it wasn't a human medicine.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Right, and that it was dangerous, even though it's actually one of the safest medications out there.
It's over the counter in numerous countries.
Yeah, yeah. And then just today, I saw a new article by Meryl Nass about hydroxychloroquine, in which she reviews the literature there. And again, it's the same story. This was very effective in treating COVID, but all we were subjected to were the lies and the exaggerations. And they did various studies in which they deliberately gave people basically overdoses of hydroxychloroquine in order to show that it was unsafe and so on and so forth. And she exposes all of this meticulously at her website.
I just want to point out, I'm going to bring this up again. I know I brought it up every time we talk about this. But the reason people used hydroxychloroquine is because it was found in 2005 to be effective on SARS-1.
Right.
Which they told us this is a novel virus never seen before in human history. And it's called SARS-2. Well, SARS-1, which was rolled out, I think, in 2002, something like that, and then disappeared, it was Dr. Fauci's lab that experimented. It was Dr. Fauci's lab that found out that hydroxychloroquine was effective.
Right.
And he says we have to do all this bioweapon research in case a virus comes, we'll know how to treat it.
Right, yeah.
But when the virus came and they went to the treatment that his own lab had found out was effective, he banned it. And this was long before, they knew this long before Trump said anything about it. And they trashed it for people with TDS. They used Trump saying something about it, I think in May, to trash it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't Trump, it was Fauci had come up with it. Just because he banned it doesn't mean that there wasn't actual research showing already.
Yeah.
Already in February, already in January, that it helped.
Yeah, yeah. Continuing on with the article. Since its inception, the diphtheria pertussis tetanus vaccination, DPT and DTP are used interchangeably, has been plagued with controversy. Before we continue, I should disclose that I am biased toward this vaccine because two members of my extended family experienced permanent brain damage from the original whole cell formulation of the vaccine. The early history of DPT is discussed in a previous article on the many attempts to create population-reducing vaccines. Quoting the earlier article, the DPT vaccine has a very questionable past. Due to a long-standing animosity between England and Ireland that originally arose over an English king wanting a divorce to be granted by the church, the English treated the Irish terribly. Unsurprisingly, Irish orphanages were used to source, likely forced, research subjects for trials of the early vaccine prototypes. In 2014, unmarked mass graves belonging to Irish orphans were discovered. Further research revealed these graves belonged to a group of 2,051 children upon whom an earlier diphtheria vaccine was covertly tested in the 1930s. Additionally, an earlier investigation had shown that early vaccine experiments, including DPT, were conducted in the 1960s to 70s at Irish care homes and the test subjects included babies and handicapped children. He adds a notice detailed by Sir Graham Wilson in the early 1900s. There were over a dozen cases documented within the medical literature, and likely far more than that weren't documented, where groups of children received an incorrectly prepared diphtheria vaccine, and collectively thousands became severely ill, with hundreds suffering an agonizing death. Diphtheria, for reference, is the D component of the DPT vaccine.
You know, and the pertussis, I know, is a bacterial disease that can be cured with a certain antibiotic. I can't remember now.
He talks about it later.
Oh, okay, yeah. So why give a dangerous vaccine for something that's easily curable?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about diphtheria.
When the DPT vaccine entered the market, statements can be found from many physicians who observed it caused the emergence of SIDS, previously termed crib death due to babies being found dead in their cribs. Although these statements are likely authentic, in most instances I have not found the source of the physician asserting that link, and therefore cannot reference them. But one exception would be Robert Mendelsohn, a remarkable pediatrician, patient advocate, and early pioneer for vaccine safety, whom I recently learned mentored a reader here. In our correspondences, that doctor informed me of a conversation that followed him, asking Mendelsohn why he was willing to sacrifice the eminent position he had earned to speak out against the medical system. And he says, Mendelsohn told me that during his appointment as medical director of Project Head Start's Medical Consultation Service in 1968, he was horrified by the discussions held privately in the White House with his medical colleagues. They were openly discussing how they could control the population of the poor by promoting infant formula vaccinations, sadistic hospital birthing practices, deficient government schools, and neighborhood abortion clinics.
I think that's infant formula, comma, vaccinations.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Yeah, because we know that infant formula is
right.
Another thing that is way more dangerous than breastfeeding for babies.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Especially for poor people. They can't afford it.
Yeah, and he adds a note here that one of the many benefits of breastfeeding is a significant reduction of SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome. In his book, How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Doctor, Mendelsohn wrote, quote, my suspicion, which is shared by others in my profession, is that the nearly 10,000 SIDS deaths that occur in the United States each year are related to one or more of the vaccines that are routinely given to children. The pertussis vaccine is the most likely villain, but it could also be one or more of the others. The Midwestern doctor adds a note, although I believe pertussis, DPT, is the vaccine most strongly linked to SIDS, other vaccines also appear to share an association. For example, a 2007 VAERS analysis of neonatal, less than 1 month old deaths, evaluated the 29 unexplained deaths reported following the hepatitis B vaccine.
See, they didn't used to give hepatitis B back then.
Yeah.
That's new.
Yeah.
It's at least since the 80s, because I worked in nursery in the 80s and we didn't give it.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
And the other thing is, DPT, the reason I think it's probably more associated than other ones is because that's all they gave. Well, but polio. They gave DPT and polio 2 months, 4 months, 6 months.
Right.
And that was it.
Yeah.
They didn't give anything else. And hepatitis, no, they didn't give hepatitis at all.
Yeah. Now, of course, the schedule is just...
starts at birth.
Yeah,
with
it's
hepatitis.
Much inflated.
Just in case your kid's going to grow up to be an IV drug abuser. But it's stupid because the newborn's immune system can't possibly mount antibiotics against hepatitis B on day one.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So anyway, the analysis of this VAERS data from 2007 and the 29 unexplained deaths found that 24 were classified as SIDS. Of the 29 total deaths, 13.8% died within 24 hours of the vaccination, 32% within 3 days, and 44.8% within 7 days. Earlier in 1999, legislative testimony by Philip Nkeo, MD, made it a case for the hepatitis B vaccine being associated with SIDS. Key piece of evidence Nkeo cited for this claim was that SIDS did not occur in those under 2 months of age until the hepatitis B vaccine entered the market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Hepatitis B is the only vaccine given before 2 months of age, a time when the immune system's ability to develop the desired antibodies that result from vaccination is impaired. And as the vaccine wears off over time, too early to later protect the child during the later years, they might engage in the blood-to-blood contact, that is the unprotected sex or sharing drug needles, necessary to transmit the disease.
That's why hepatitis B is so rare in America, except for among IV drug abuse and promiscuous gay men. Those are the two groups that get it.
Right.
Right? So why does every newborn baby get a hepatitis B vaccine? It's insane, as I said, unless you think that profits are the most important thing, more important than human health.
Yeah.
Or life.
In 1985, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, that's the name of a book or paper, was published. This damning indictment of the DPT vaccine was pivotal in the cheaper but more dangerous wholesale formulation being withdrawn from the domestic market, and acellular formulation replaced it. Its publication also helped create the political will for the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, established 20 months later because many of the parents who successfully lobbied members of Congress to take on the issue of vaccine injury had DPT-injured children. At the time, this law appeared to be a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, the U.S. government failed to uphold the spirit of what the law intended, and instead it only served to grant vaccine manufacturers immunity for producing unsafe vaccines. And he adds a note, the history behind that law is discussed in much more detail here. He's got a link. We've talked about that too, you know, something like, I think, all the vaccine injuries over the COVID vaccine, I think only 6 people have gotten any compensation at all under
That's
this program.
Ridiculous.
And it was a minor amount of money. So yeah, it's absurd. From that, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, I learned that pertussis bacteria are highly immunogenic pathogens with many toxic components. As a result, the existing manufacturing techniques, based on culturing and then killing large numbers of the bacteria to create the raw vaccine material, could never produce a clean vaccine free of side effects. I also suspect the later development of a less toxic acellular DPT vaccine, which took quite a bit of work, was initiated in response to a wave of lawsuits for injuries by the more toxic wholesale formulation. As mentioned before, there were also significant issues with inactivating the diphtheria toxin. As somewhat of a parallel, Meryl Nass, MD, we talked about her earlier, is one of the foremost experts on anthrax vaccine injuries, which were what most likely caused the severe illness that afflicted over 100,000 service members. Nass, who was able to directly review documents unearthed by a congressional investigation of the vaccine, believes the most probable cause of the anthrax vaccine's toxicity was it being an inherently dirty vaccine due to the raw material necessary to produce it. The vaccine manufacturer, Bioport, further worsened the vaccine by making the misguided choice to use larger filters, which let more problematic contaminants into the final vaccine, because the smaller filters were clogged by the vaccine ingredients, large quantities of killed but still toxic anthrax bacteria. Due to the perceived danger of infection with the highly immunogenic pertussis bacteria, the medical field and the governing bodies overseeing immunization programs assumed that a certain number of injuries were an acceptable trade-off to mitigate the significant dangers posed by pertussis. However, by the time pertussis became a relatively mild illness, most likely due to improvements in public sanitation or public nutrition, hence no longer justifying a dangerous vaccine, there was enough inertia behind DPT that attempts to curtail its use met fierce resistance. And then he added that pertussis can be treated with antibiotics, which you pointed out before, while many outside the conventional medical system find vitamin C is remarkably effective for treating it. As reports of injuries from the DPT vaccine exploded following the continually increased administration of the vaccine, widespread allegiance to the vaccine resulted in the victims of DPT and the physicians who reported the injuries being attacked instead of listened to. Some of these reports, including those resulting in death, were summarized within DPT, A Shot in the Dark, and the indented passages that follow are direct quotations from it. Death, and this is quoting that book now, death was the first reaction to be associated with the pertussis vaccine. Thorvald Madsen, the Danish vaccine pioneer, published an article in 1933 describing the deaths of 2 babies a few hours after they had been vaccinated. One had hiccups and convulsions, while the other had nothing more visible than a bluish tint of the skin. Following his report, other physicians added their own case histories of infant deaths immediately following pertussis vaccination. In 1946, Warren and Garrow described the deaths of identical twins within 24 hours of their second shot. Cases of identical twins developing a condition immediately following an intervention are often considered a gold standard in proving causality.
I can't imagine carrying twins to term, having them, and then nurturing them, and then they both die the same day because you go in and get them a shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine what that mother, she must have went nuts.
I know, that's just horrible. If SIDS occur spontaneously, it is virtually impossible it would happen in the same amount of time after vaccination in twin infants. That article reviewing 13 cases of simultaneous twin deaths, 10 of which were officially certified as SIDS, discusses the near impossibility of these events being due to chance. Likewise, while we know of many cases of SIDS occurring immediately after vaccination, we do not know of any that happened prior to vaccination. He adds a note, this also holds true for sudden regressions into autism. Due to the political ramifications of these types of reports, American physicians are highly reluctant to publish these incidents in the current era. Nonetheless, many case reports, such as the 10 cited in the above article, do exist. Some cases are as follows. To quote a 2006 report from Turkey, twin girls, 3.5 months old, were found dead by their mother in their crib, both in the supine position, lying on their backs. The infants were identical twins and delivered at a hospital by cesarean section. Both infants were healthy and did not have any serious medical history. 2 days before the incident, the twins had received the second dose of oral polio, DPT, and the first dose of hepatitis B vaccines. They had a fever on the first day of the vaccination and were given a teaspoonful of acetaminophen. Death scene investigation, judicial investigation, parental assessment, macroscopic and microscopic autopsy findings, and the toxicological analyses yielded no specific cause of death. Other case reports of twins dying immediately following vaccination include a 1987 case report of twins who simultaneously succumbed to sudden unexpected deaths 3 hours after DPT vaccination. A 2007 case report of healthy 15-week-old identical twins who both died suddenly 2 days after receiving oral polio, hepatitis B, and DPT vaccines and were found by their mother both in the supine position. A 2010 case report of 12-week-old identical twins who died lying on their backs 5 days after receiving 6 vaccines concurrently, and a 2013 case report of 10-week-old twins who were both found dead, both in the supine position, and 10 days earlier they had received their first doses of DPT and oral polio vaccines. Now he adds a note here, I emphasize them being in the supine position, that is on their backs, as SIDS is often blamed on infants sleeping face down and suffocating themselves.
Yes.
So this disproves this.
That just started somewhere in the late 90s because I remember being flabbergasted by that. What?
Yeah.
Laying on your back? What if they vomit and inhale it and choke? Number one. Number two, I had worked intensive care nursery, as you know, and I had babies on monitors, and we tube fed them, so every time before we gave them the new feeding, we would pull out the residual of the old feeding, and babies oxygenated better on their stomachs, their heart rate was better on their stomachs, their breathing was, they slept better, and they digested their food better. I knew all of that. So when they started saying this bull about being supine, killing them, I was just outraged, because what that's doing is, it's making the mother's life harder. It's much easier to have a baby stay asleep on its stomach. So they're like deliberately screwing over women. Are they going to change that SIDS nonsense now? No.
No, of course not.
No, don't let evidence stop you.
Yeah. Well, from these reports about the twins, he goes on and discusses some even more comprehensive studies that were done showing these links. But we are about out of time here. Again, highly recommend this article. If you think that all vaccines are safe and just do what the CDC says, well, you ought to look at the real evidence. And this article is entitled, The Century of Evidence That Vaccine Caused Sudden Infant Deaths. And again, you can find it at MidwesternDoctor.com. Thanks for listening to Class Matters. We'll be with you again next Monday.